You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. I am Josh Felber, where we uncover the success strategies and the mindsets of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business today. I'm really excited for today's guest. I've read most of his books. Now, I won't say all, but most of his books is Stephen Kotler. He's a New York Times best-selling author, an award-winning journalist, and co-founder director of research for the Flow Genome Project. He's also one of the world's leading experts on high performance, disruptive technology, and innovation. He's also the author of 8 books, including Stealing Fire, Rise of Superman, Tomorrowland, Bold, and Abundance, which are both with Peter Diamandis, and West of Jesus, A Small Fury Prayer, and The Angel's Quickest for Flight. His writings have been translated in over 40 different languages and has appeared in over 80 publications, including the New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, Forbes, Wired, and Time. Along with his wife, author Joy Nicholson, Stephen is the co-founder of Rancho de Cholula.
Chihuahua.
My bad. You know, I almost was going to go that direction. I'm like, wait a minute. Maybe it's something totally not what it is. I should have went with first instinct.
That's right. My wife and I, we co-run a whorehouse in Nevada. That's exactly right. That's Rancho de Cholula. Not a dog sanctuary.
Right.
Not a no. It's a brothel.
It's a brothel. Yeah, for dogs. a dog sanctuary in the mountains of northern Mexico.
New Mexico.
Yeah, New Mexico, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. He's got a BA from the University of Wisconsin, Madison, an MA from Johns Hopkins University, and whenever possible, he can be found hurling himself down mountains at high speeds, just like we all love to do. So, Stephen, I want to welcome you to Making Bank today.
That was heroic of you.
So it always makes it more fun in the intro bio intro thing.
Did you get that part of the email where I said, you know, shorten this at will? No, you missed that, huh? You should read your emails more closely.
I had them just cut that out for me and just drop it in a little Word document so I can blow it up real huge. So I missed that section. Yes. They didn't translate that piece over.
Trim it will. Trim it will is what it said.
Yeah. Well, awesome, man. Well, I'm excited to have you on the show. The books I've read, I've loved. It's for me. I've always been into love high performance and kind of pushing yourself to the next level. And so I think that's why a lot of the stuff that you write, disruptive technology, everything just really connects with me. So definitely welcome to Making Bank.
Well, thanks for having me. It was really nice of you to say so. Appreciate that.
So I guess tell me a little bit about, I just finished reading Stealing Fire. And I guess tell me a little about your background and kind of what drove you that direction to write the book.
So I, alongside my partner, Jamie Wheel, who I co-wrote the book with, we study flow states. So those kind of optimal states of consciousness where you feel your best and you perform your best. You may call them runner's high, being in the zone, whatever. Those moments are kind of total absorption, rapt attention, right? You're so focused on task at hand, everything else vanishes and performance goes through the roof. And we were, Flow Genome Project, you know, besides kind of being the subject of a lot of my books, what we do is we're a research and training organization, right? So on the training side, it's everybody from kind of the U.S. Special Forces through Fortune 100 companies. And that had us sort of running around the world, talking to different people about high performance, really elite kind of high performing organizations. Totally honest, flow is an altered state of consciousness, right? And it's one, it's got a 150 year track record of improving performance. We've got a lot of the science, we understand what's going on, but I'm still walking into mainstream businesses and training them up in the use of an altered state of consciousness, which from my perspective was a little weird, right? It was not business as usual.
Right.
So, but that's not the strange part. The strange part is sort of what, you know, Jamie and I discovered along the way, which was the became the core foundational research in Stealing Fire, which was sort of everywhere we went, we were interested in one particular altered state of consciousness to improve performance. And everywhere we went, using a mad variety of techniques,
sure,
people were, you know, hacking consciousness to improve performance. So this was, we were talking about Dave Asprey a second ago off air. This was the Dave Asprey biohacker crowd, you know, stacking nutraceuticals out the wazoo. This was Wall Street traders zapping their brains with electrodes, kind of to silence their prefrontal cortex and help them make better, more creative trades. Sure. Radar operators doing the same thing. We met teams of engineers at Fortune 100 companies that will remain unnamed, who were admittedly like microdosing with psychedelics on a regular basis. Wow. To massively improve creativity. And this was years before, I mean, in February, GQ put Why Your Boss Wants You to Do LSD at Work on their cover, right? This was years before that happened. So right. It was starting to show up, and we were like, what's going on? We met, you know, famous founders of huge companies going to Burning Man, doing heroic doses of psychedelics for the insight and inspiration it gave them that they were carrying back into their business life. Everywhere we went, Navy SEALs who had come off of 2-week silent meditation treats, or Navy SEALs who had come back from Tony Robbins workshops, which is even more incredible.
Yeah.
Everywhere we went, people were using a variety of techniques to hack consciousness and improve performance. And it started to look a lot bigger than flow and a lot bigger than what we had thought was going on. And so, you know, investigating this, trying to figure out what this was, where it was coming from, how much did it matter, was kind of the foundation of Stealing Fire. So, you know, that's sort of the chunk of my background that gets us to current.
Sure. Cool. No, and that's, you know, and I guess you kind of mentioned something a little bit earlier, was you get to kind of be the test subjects along the way for what your research is.
On a lot of levels, yes, which might explain the 82 broken bones.
So it's not just like, hey, cool, we found all this information, let's just put it all together. A lot of the parts of what you're writing about and doing, you've put yourself in those positions to go through it and to really get the depth and understanding of what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, it starts out very personal. And once we think we have it worked into kind of any actual learning sequence, anything that's teachable,
sure,
right, anything that's real, but before we kind of publish on it, we tend to run classes around it, like open source, like beta test the ideas. So, for example, we developed a program for Google. We ran a joint learning exercise with Google trying to, induce flow in like 50 or 60 people from mixed categories, all from all over the company a couple of years ago, to test out some of these ideas and, you know, that sort of thing. So yeah, we run them on ourselves then and hammer them out back and forth, you know, and then, you know, the Flow Genome Project it's a giant open source research project. So there's a lot of people involved who we can sort of test this shit on.
Right.
And then we can roll it into the realer world. Along the way. But we, you know, our one of our mottos is always conduct the experiment.
Right. Cool. Maybe give us a little background for people that are not familiar with what flow state is. I know we're talking altered mind, you know, altered state of conscious and stuff like that. But people are, you know, listening may be like, man, I kind of understand, but I don't really understand what he's talking about. So kind of maybe give us a quick 30-second overview of what that specifically might be.
Well, as I mentioned, flow is an altered state of consciousness, right? Where we're in an optimal state, we feel our best and we perform our best, right? We get so focused on whatever we're doing that everything else vanishes. So action and awareness will merge. Your sense of self will disappear. Time will pass strangely. It can slow down. You'll get a freeze frame effect sometimes from your interviews in a car crash. More frequently, what happens to most of us is like 5 hours pass by in 5 minutes. We don't even notice. And throughout, all aspects of performance, mental and physical, go through the roof. Couple more things that are worth knowing about flow just to kind of ground our listeners. As I said, flow science is old. It dates back to the 1870s, first time we actually started running real research on it. But in the 1970s, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, sort of the godfather of flow psychology at the University of Chicago, he discovers really three foundational things about flow. The first is that it's definable. So flow has 10 core characteristics, and I just listed some of them. Right. Merger of action and awareness, total focus in the present moment, vanishing of self, etc. He discovers it's ubiquitous, it's universal, shows up in everyone, anywhere, provided certain emission conditions are met. Besides the fact that it's been linked to high performance, he actually figures out that it's psychologically, foundationally important. And by doing what was then the largest study ever conducted in optimal performance, he discovers that the people on the planet who have the most flow in their lives, spend the most time in the state, are the happiest. Not happiest, wrong word. That are the people who test off the charts for overall well-being, life satisfaction. So the state tends to really amplify meaning and purpose and passion and those sorts of things.
No, and that's awesome. I know for me, being around fitness and just pushing myself, I mean, I've noticed when I've been in those states and that feeling where everything just seems to really just move and just happen easily and effortlessly a lot of times. And I remember reading it in the book, was it talks also about, it's also elusive. It's hard to sometimes get that dialed in. So for me, it was always, I could run or I could do a high intensity workout or something of that nature and be able to put myself in that state. But then other times it's like, okay, how do I get in that state if I'm not able to do those specific things?
And that's a lot of the work we've done at the Flow Genome Project, right? And that's a lot of, you know, Rise of Superman, kind of the second half of that covers that very thing. What we've learned over the past 10, 15 years is that flow states have triggers, right? Sure. Preconditions that lead to more flow. Exercise is packed with them, right? One of the reasons it's such a sure route in. But a lot of the work we've done is sort of, you know, we worked on action adventure sport athletes who get into the flow very easily, and we want to know how is this happening? Why is this happening? And can we bridge the gap from the extreme to the mainstream? And so that's sort of what we've tried to do but what we've been working on kind of over the past, you know, half decade.
So I guess what are some of those processes along the way that you found to really be able to kind of bridge that gap?
Let's just start really simply, right? With sort of two foundational basics, I would say, or maybe we'll do three. One is flow follows focus, right? It can only show up when all of your attention is focused on the right here, right now. And what the research has shown is that blocking time for uninterrupted concentration, where you're going to turn off your cell phone, turn off your, you know, instant messages, no social media, no anything, just focused attention time. Most effective are really 90 to 120 minute blocks, by the way. You can do hour long blocks. When we go into organizations, one of the first things we do is say, look, man, if you can't put a sign on your door that says, fuck off, I'm flowing, and be by yourself for you're really costing your organization. You are. If you look at, you know, scientists have spent a long time trying to quantify what is the boost you get in flow. We know where it's coming from. We understand the neurobiology and, you know, we understand what it does to performance in a lot of different categories. And you see huge spikes in productivity, in motivation, in learning, in creative problem solving, right? So very huge, like 500% spikes, huge numbers, crazy. Wow. It's crazy. It's almost hard to believe them. And if they didn't come from so many different reputed sources, you wouldn't, right?
Right.
But as I said, there's 150 years of this data at this point, and it's just overwhelming. My point is, you know, 120 minutes of uninterrupted concentration for most organizations, they think, oh my God, you're wasting so much, you know what I mean? You're wasting so much of your time. And in fact, the productivity spikes are so big, you're actually gaining hours a day back as a result. So, you know, simple foundational baseline practice. Another one, so what is known as the golden rule of flow. And if you know anything about flow, you've probably heard this before, and it's called the challenge skills balance. And what this means is we tend to pay the most attention to the task at hand, right? We can focus all our attention in the now to drive the flow when the challenge of that task slightly exceeds our skill set. So you want to stretch, but not snap. Now, if I was going to say this emotionally to you, to Josh, flow exists not on, but near the midpoint between boredom, not enough anxiety, I'm not paying attention, and stimulation, right?
Okay.
Way too much anxiety, paying too much attention. So a couple things that are interesting. For your audience, first of all, a couple of years ago, Csikszentmihalyi and a Google mathematician teamed up. They tried to figure out what's the exact balance between challenge and skills.
Sure.
Came up with a rough back of the envelope calculation of a 4% difference. Now, okay. First of all, that's very subjective, but we have taken that number. We have tested it with a lot of professional athletes, actually, on training rituals, on recovery, all that kind of stuff. And we've seen it seem it's fairly accurate, which is interesting. Well, obviously, a ton more stuff needs to go. But the reason I mention this is 4%. If I said to you, hey, tomorrow you got to wake up and I need you to just push 4% harder than you did today, right? Like your week goal is I want to be 4% better than I was last week, right? You would look at me like, dude, are you crazy? I'm not like that's not nearly enough because high performers will take on challenges that are 20% greater.
Right.
But like, no, I don't want half the cake. I'll have all the cake and the donuts, right? Like we want, that's what we do. And the thing is, by knocking yourself past that 4%, you're raising fear levels, anxiety levels.
Okay.
And that will actually block flow. You get bursts of norepinephrine, little bit, great, drives focus, makes you feel awake, too much, and you're absolutely screwed when it comes to high performance. And the high performance basic, which comes right off of what I just said, is sleep hygiene matters. Right? Getting enough sleep really, really matters. If for no other reason than most people don't realize this, but when you're tired, your brain ramps up your safety and security functions, right? The amygdala goes into overdrive. You start producing more norepinephrine, more cortisol, because your brain is going, hey man, you're tired. You're a little slow. You're a little weak, dangerous, a little more dangerous. So you may not even notice it. Right? It may feel like you just didn't sleep an extra 45 minutes. Who cares?
Right.
But there's a part of your brain that is burning a lot more energy constantly to deal with that threat. So like there's a lot of hidden costs to fear and lack of sleep and things like that we don't see. And they really impact performance. So that's, by the way, I think maybe the most, these are really, really basic high performance. What we can we do tips, but you know, I figured we'd start foundationally.
No, definitely. And I mean, you mentioned sleep, and that's key. And that's one thing, I mean, if it's entrepreneurs, and I've always kind of wrestled with, okay, what is that right amount? Is it the 8 hours? Is it the 6 hours? And then how is it, how deep and how, you know, I guess into the sleep you are through the thing? Because I know I track all that and I watch and I do different things. And
well, like, you've probably found what I've found, first of all, which is like, I don't think everybody's different, right?
Everybody's
totally, completely, you know, this is one thing we find when I said earlier that our motto is conduct the experiment. And the reason is one of the things over and over and over, I believe about high performance is why I am a little vaguely suspicious of a lot of nutraceutical, you know, kind of approaches because everybody's different. Right. That's what I've learned. And, you know, certainly that's true with flow. There are 20 triggers. But your nature, nurture, background, whatever is going to say you're most susceptible to these triggers. And by the way, that's not fixed in time. That's today, right? Like a year from now. Because, I mean, let me give you one example. Risk is a flow trigger, right? Always has focus, attention. Access sport athletes get a lot of it. Top business executives, right? Wall Street traders, lots of, right? Coaches, all the, right, produces a lot of risk. Focuses attention, you get a lot of flow as a result. Your risk predilection is shaped by how active your dopamine receptors are. Some of that is genetic. Some of it can be impacted over time, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively. If you're a chronic pot smoker, you're going to get less active dopamine receptors over time, for example. That's going to change your risk profile, things like that. So that's what I mean by like everybody's a set of one. It changes over time, right? I mean, there are general things. You can go to the Flow Genome Project website and we have a free flow profile. It says you're this kind of person, you're like find flow in this direction. Right? That's a tautology. It's based on dominant personality characteristics, big five stuff. It's a little more stable over time. So, it's useful longitudinally. But it still can shift, and most people find they have a dominant category and a subcategory.
Since it, you know, kind of it varies per person, and like you said, is then testing and really monitoring ourselves and what that range is.
Really matters.
Okay, awesome. And so then I know in the book you talk a lot about the whole part about microdosing and those kind of things.
So let's back in there for a second. So here's what one of the things we discovered by one of the things that some of the work that I was involved in was flow researchers were really balkanized. The neuroanatomy guys weren't talking to the psychologists, weren't talking to the education research. Everybody was ignoring the artists, right? Like, so a lot of what I did is I tried to bring all that stuff together in one place. And it had never really been done before. And one of the things that gave us is sort of a loose Rosetta Stone for the neurobiology of a lot of different altered states. And so what we saw is a couple of things. First of all, let me do this historically because it's the easiest way in. 100 years ago, William James, so the founding father of American psychology, is teaching at Harvard, and he's really interested in altered states of consciousness, and he makes an observation. He says, if you look at flow states or meditative states or some of the mystical states, trance states, out-of-body experiences, sure, speaking tongues, those kinds of things, and psychedelic states, and awe was the last one. He said, a lot of these states share a lot of overlapping properties. They seem to have the same psychological impact on people, and I think they're kind of the same thing. Okay. So what he's actually pointing at is what we would call the ecstatic spectrum of the kind of altered state, right, of altered states. Ecstatic is literally a word, comes from the Greek ecstasis. It means to step out beyond myself, so to shut off normal waking consciousness and right, to be filled with, they call it divine inspiration. We would call it insight or heightened creative problem solving or whatever, right? Intuition. Sure. So it's 100 years later, and what we discovered is James was totally right. The same neurobiology, the same changes in brain function that underpin flow are really similar to what happens in awe and meditation and psychedelic states. Roughly the same knobs and levers in the brain are being tweaked. So these are all the same experiences. They make us feel the same way, right? Jake Silva famously calls, altered states the language without words that we all speak. Because it doesn't matter. Like, you could be, a farmer in India having a vision of Ganesh in your rice paddy, or you could be an executive on Wall Street zapping your brain with electrodes. Like, totally different states. They seem to mean totally different things, but they make us feel how on the inside the exact same. And that's because the neurobiology that's underneath that feeling, it's the exact same. That's what we discovered. So, what we're seeing right now with the spread of microdosing is one phenomenal example, right? People are tapping into these states. So, like, let's just talk about creative problem solving, for example, three variations on the theme, and we'll talk about microdosing for starters. So we know flow researchers have discovered, and we did some of this work, it's been done all over the place, some of it was at Harvard, University of Sydney in Australia, flow tends to push creativity up 400 to 700%. It does this because at the heart of creativity is the brain's pattern recognition system, the ability to link ideas together, right? And when you go into flow, the neurochemicals that show up in the state, they surround the brain's information processing machinery. We take in more information per second, pay more attention to it, and we find links between that information and older ideas more quickly, right? So as a result, creativity spikes, creative problem solving spikes, 400 to 700%. Microdosing, sublingual, right? It's psychedelics, but you're taking so little amount that you get no psychedelic effects.
Okay.
You feel a little altered. You feel like you've drank maybe two or three cups of coffee, right? Maybe right, taking a little bit of a Daffodil kind of thing, but sure, like you're totally functional. You're a little off kind of thing. But James Fadiman has been researching, creative problem solving and microdosing since the 60s. And he's found you get a 200% spike in creative problem solving, and that microdosing is especially effective at getting you past stuckedness, right? Which is what they call it.
Right.
Like, I've got almost a great idea and I can't get it to, market or finish it or whatever it is.
Sure.
So we've seen that, interestingly, by the way, meditation does the same thing.
Okay.
Right. We see, so it's right, three different techniques. You can use flow states, you can use microdosing, or you could use meditation. They're But because the underlying neurobiology is the same, you see similar spikes in creativity. And the meditation stuff, by the way, they did an experiment at the University of Carolina where they were looking at, we knew back in the 90s that like 30,000 hours of meditation, like so 30 years produced, tuned the brain. So it was really like right on the brink of aha breakthroughs. And it was really cool, but like who the hell's got 30 years, right? So like not a finding with much practical value. So over the years, they've tried to reduce it. Each time they've been like, well, okay, maybe it's 10 years. Let's just, 10 years is more manageable. And they find they're right. Right now they're in 2009 at the University of North Carolina, they found that 4 days of meditation is enough to chunk down anxiety levels in the brain, amplify critical problem solving abilities and creative abilities. You're not going to get the huge 30-year spike of on the breakthrough, but like 4 days,
yeah,
right? So, which is pretty crazy. And I think where this gets even crazier is you can now layer technology, a Muse EEG headset, for example, on top of your 20-minute breath training, and suddenly you're steering the brain towards that alpha theta border where you have lots of gamma spikes, and suddenly you're a lot closer to that, what 30 years can give you, and you've done like what 6 weeks of practice is what most studies show to get you regularly near that border. That's crazy.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Right? Like that's crazy. That's, you know, if you think about it as meditation is like 8,000 years of spiritual tradition and wisdom going into something that's been gussied up with, you know, neuroscience and technology over the past 20 years, say, and suddenly we can do it 30 years, no monastery required. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
In a month, right? We were talking about, you know, Dave's 30 days of Zen.
Yeah, the 40 years of Zen. Yeah.
40 years of Zen, right? I mean, it's the same idea, right?
Like, right.
All of this stuff is sort of going on, and the big point of Stealing Fire is, one, these things are interchangeable, and you know, you can make decisions based on who you are, what your risk predilections are, what kind of job you do, what are your exact needs. You can tune these states with increasing precision. You can get access to them on demand. All of this is continuing to accelerate.
Yeah, the Muse part of it, as my kids and they every day. You know, it's as awesome. I mean, they're like 6 and 8 and they're doing that. And it's really cool to see how they're able to drop and get down into that super calm state.
In Rise of Superman, because it was about action sport athletes and they were, because the stuff they do is so dangerous,
right?
You have to be in flow to do this stuff. So they were way ahead of the curve. It was necessity. Well, a lot of those athletes had kids, right? Okay. So those kids became the first generation of children to actually be trained with sort of, you know, flow kind of training, some of the earth neurotech, like they understood the value. And what I documented in Rise of Superman is explains why you have 12-year-old skateboarders beating out 40-year-old skateboarders, right?
Right.
What I think you're seeing with your kids is the first, like, I don't want to say mainstream because that may be insulting to you, but white generation, right, of kids who are doing what the action sport athletes, like they're a generation behind what was going on. But what we saw, if what we saw with the action sport athletes is any indication of where the Muse headset training on 6-year-olds is going to lead.
Oh, yeah.
Scout, right? it's look out. It's going to get really weird really fast.
Well, it's crazy. I know. I mean, you know, I'm 44, so it's like, just thinking back, man, just having that or even understanding that.
Let's ask you a question. When I was a teenager, if somebody would have just taught me the value of, I don't know, deep breathing.
Right.
To just calm down my nervous system.
Sure. It would have been huge.
Probably could have saved me a lot of broken skin, this or that, etc.
Yeah. Okay, we only got a few minutes left. So give me maybe like 3 highlights from the book that you feel are really important and that as entrepreneurs, it's something that we can apply to what we do.
First thing you need to know is this, and it's a slightly longer story, but it's so critical, especially to your audience. So I'm going to walk in through a weird door, but over the past 15 years, scientists from every imaginable discipline, zoology, anthropology, psychopharmacology, whatever, have discovered that pretty much every mammal, many birds and even some insects have figured out a way to alter their consciousness.
Okay.
You've probably seen this in your kids. Kids will spin in circles. They'll hyperventilate. They'll roll down hills.
Sure.
Right? All of this talk, kind of knock out normal waking consciousness and tap into something else.
Right.
Happens all over the animal kingdom. Birds will chew on marijuana seeds. Cats get high on catnip.
Right.
Iboga root, which is ibogaine, a really powerful psychedelic. Jaguars in the Amazon will eat ayahuasca roots. Mm. And it, like, this goes on and on and on. Dolphins get stoned on puffer fish toxin, right? I mean, the list is endless. It's literally almost all mammals. And so the question, like, after they discovered all this, the next question was, well, what the hell for, right? Like, stone birds behave like stoned humans. They fly in our windshields and go splat. Like,
right.
It's not always the best species strategy for survival. So why is it so omnipresent was the question. And what they've discovered is that animals everywhere get stuck in ruts. They'll do the same shit over and over and over, expecting different results.
Right.
Only way to stop doing that is to turn off the self, the part of your brain that is still stuck in that rut, get that widened, higher perspective you get in these non-ordinary states of consciousness,
sure.
Right? In other words, what we've discovered is that altered states of consciousness are the very tool evolution gave us for innovation. It's how we innovate.
Right.
It's how we solve certain kinds of creative problems. It's actually, for other reasons, how we collaborate and how we best cooperate. So, two things are key off of this. One is one of the reasons entrepreneurs and one of the reasons businesses have such a hard time training employees up in skills like creative problem solving, collaboration, cooperation, et cetera,
sure.
Because we keep trying to train up a skill, and what we need to be training is a state of mind. That's what the data consistently shows.
Right.
Okay, so that's point A. Point B, you asked me for three things. That's one. Here's two. We're coming off the same idea. So Jamie and I at the Flow Genome Project wanted to measure this. So this urge to intoxication that scientists have found, they started doing more research, and they now call it a fourth evolutionary driver. Our first three drivers are the urge for sex, shelter, and sustenance, right? Like, these are basic evolutionary drivers. This urge to intoxication, they believe, is as powerful as these first three drivers, a fundamental thing. So Jamie and I decided to do something we don't think it's ever been done before. We decided we wanted to put some numbers around an evolutionary driver. So we spent 6 months with a team of researchers putting together the altered state economy. This is how much money do we spend, sometimes intentionally, right, the biohacker zapping their brains, so intentionally, the executive pounding cocktails at happy hour on Friday, right? How often, how far do we go out of our way? How much time and money do we spend trying to alter our consciousness? And we were as conservative as possible. And we looked at everything from legal and illegal drugs through, like, self-help workshops, not the, like, skills acquisition stuff, but like Tony Robbins, Giant Within seminars, where he's trying to change your consciousness, right? We looked at recreational activities, gambling, action sports, etc. And really, as cautious as possible, our number was $4 trillion a year.
Wow.
In context, that's 1/16 of the global economy. It is more than the GDP of Britain or India or Russia. It is how much we spend trying to get out of our mind. And here's the thing that is important for your audience, and this is my last thing, which is, for entrepreneurs, it means there's $4 trillion of opportunity out there right now, today, waiting, right? And I mean, if you look at even like Tim Ferriss has pulled all his
sure.
money out of VCing, and he's trying to build a microdosing pharmacological performance company, right?
Right.
Like, that's what he's doing,
yeah.
right? Like, so like, we're seeing this. If you look at the rising number of patents for consciousness hacking technology, you know, it went from like, I think in 2010, the figures are in the book, but it was like 900 a year, and then it doubled to 1,800, and then doubled again to 3,600, and now it's like over 11,000 a year.
Right.
New neurotech patents. Elon Musk has his brain implant company. I mean, this is not slowing down, is my point.
Right.
Right.
It's definitely a huge, and I mean, that number, 4 trillion. conservative.
It's shocking, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would have not even guessed anywhere close to that.
You have to, understand, like, since we're going over, like, that's what happened. Jamie and I bumped into all these people who were doing this everywhere.
Sure.
And he's like, Steven, I think it looks like a revolution. And I'm like the cynical journalist, dude. And I was like, man, I want to see some hard numbers.
Right.
Like, show me the money.
Right. Yeah.
Revolution my ass. Right. And you know what? He was so right. It was so thick. I suspected. I was so wrong.
But that's the great thing about it is it's definitely no awesome. It's I mean, I love what you guys are doing. I mean, this book really connected with me. Same with The Rise of Superman. And just, I mean, for me, even an example is a couple years ago, I came out and did a ton of research on neurotropics and just tested everything. I'm like, man, I want to come out one because there's the ones I've used. Yeah, this one works. Well, this piece of it works. And finally, we just bought all of them, had like 8 people, and we started testing them all the way up.
What luck? Because, okay, I want to know if what you learned matches what I learned. What did you learn?
Well, so testing all the different ones, I mean, we tested mostly the normal OTC, the over-the-counter nutraceuticals, that kind of thing. We did tried some modafinil, things like that. But then we looked at, okay, cool. We measured the side effects. Okay, well, what are the side effects of these compared to this? And then we tried to come up with something that eliminated a lot of the holes in the nutraceutical type stuff. And that's how we came out and rolled out a product called Brain Boost. And we've used paracetam and artichoke extract and a lot of different brain conditionings and delivery mechanisms to really get everything into the brain quickly and everything else. For me, we found that there was, like I said, all holes. But, and I think you mentioned it earlier, especially when we were talking about sleep, was everybody's different. And that was one of the things that we found. And certain things that were really basic type things, products worked really well on some people, but then didn't do anything for like myself and some of the other people.
Let me ask you just one follow up here, because it's something when I did all that stuff, even the stuff I got benefit from,
sure,
right? And usually for me, and this is end to one, I don't like speedy.
Right.
Speedy bothers me, yes. Right? Especially if it's norepinephrine based. Which so many of them are based on the norepinephrine system. That's not a feeling I like. So,
right.
And norepinephrine, when I feel that, it doesn't make me smarter. It actually makes me dumber, less social, and whatever. So that was major drawback in almost everything. But the other thing that I found, if that wasn't an issue, is stuff had a really good 1 month to 6 week window of high performance.
Sure.
And then a plateau.
Correct.
I have yet with, like, you know, there's very few things that I found. Oh, fish oil, I think, works over time.
Definitely fish oil, yeah.
A couple other things I found that work over time. But for me, and again, end to one, I never comment on anybody's product.
Right.
I'm a weird dude and stuff works to me differently. Right. So end to one. But like, I still haven't found anything that works long term. And the only thing I've heard from people is modafinil, but I've had some friends who have gone bonkers on it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, in the nut house, lock them up, you know, like total. I mean, it only lasted a weekend.
Yeah.
But like, you know, it's like overdosing on speed. And like, this wasn't like some junkie who had some, you know, experience. It was like Silicon Valley guys who were plagued with neurotropics and like, you know, just went round the bend and they've never even seen the bend before, let alone gone around it.
Yeah, no, you know, and what's interesting is we had a lot of the people, even myself included, kind of that same experience is I don't really care. Same with like pre-workout supplements, stuff like that. I don't care for that. Like
that speedy feeling.
Very speedy, yep. Energy kind of a thing. You know, I want more of that focus, that almost that flow state, kind of that focus, concentration, and everything. And that's what we tried to create with it. I think we're pretty close or we were, you know, with it and stuff. We've never really pushed it and marketed it really huge because paracetam is kind of on that gray line. But from a marketing perspective, I guess.
There certainly are a lot of people in your space who are hawking this version or that version of it. So I appreciate the caution.
Right. So, but yeah, no, I mean, I use it. I've used it pretty much nonstop for 2 years. And I mean, I use fish oils and Dave's MCT oil, things like that as well. Keto, I try to, you know, stay in a ketogenic state a lot of the times and everything as well. So I think that combination really helps overall. And, you know, and then there's times you just take a week off, totally disengage and let the system refresh itself and everything. So
yeah, I will say one thing, oddly, on the diet thing, because I have played with every goddamn thing you could possibly imagine.
Right.
Over the years, and nothing, I found nothing interesting. And I got a really weird stomach thing where my stomach lining got attacked by a virus.
Oh, wow.
So it burned out a lot of it. So I became really intolerant to both dairy and wheat for the first time in my life.
Sure.
And
okay.
It's been 6 months ago. So after I got over the unpleasantness, shall we say, which lasted like 3 or 4 months, and I, you know, my stomach was not right. But once that went away, I found that no wheat, no dairy, which is not quite totally ketogenic, but it pushes me close, a lot closer. I'm not a lot of sugar either.
Right.
I am shocked by the level of kind of focus and energy that I've actually, like, I'm totally blown away by it.
I agreed. I mean, I'm not intolerant to those, fortunately, but I, not having them, notice a huge difference. I mean, we try not to, I mean, our kids have it here and there, but not on a continuous basis, daily.
Everybody breaks down and goes for the ice cream every now and again.
Right.
Like, it's going to happen.
And if you try to block it, it's going to be worse later. So it's like, yes, might as well.
It's going to be worse later. I agree. And also, like, I know I run out of willpower to serve. You know what I mean? Like, I go so hard during the day. Like, so you get me 7 to 8 o'clock, like, I am vulnerable to anything.
Right.
Right. I try to, like, you got to hide during certain hours.
You're right. That's the time to go ask. Well, cool. Awesome, man. I loved you having coming on the show today. Definitely want to circle back and have you on again and dive in. I think we got a ton more stuff that we can talk about. It went really quick. So it was an honor to have you spend your time, share your information and knowledge. And any last words that you want to leave before we got to go?
Have an awesome Thursday.
That works.
And Godspeed.
Oh, Godspeed. Where
do I not on my boat who doth not fear the whale?
Where should people find out more? Do you want them to go get more information?
Yeah, sure. Stealingfirebook.com gives you what you need on Stealing Fire. Flowgenomeproject.com gives you that free flow profile and everything you want to know about flow. Stephen Kotler, StevenKotler.com.
Awesome.
Gives you all things me and everything I've written and blah, blah, blah.
Cool. Well, excellent. And we'll have all the links right here. So everybody will be able to click on them and come check you out and everything. So again, thank you for coming on Making Bank. It was an honor to have you today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me out.
I am Josh Felber. You are watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, Success Thinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.